Welcome to this podcast of Sunday nights on ABC Local Radio. I hope you enjoy the program. You're on Sunday night on ABC Radio. John Cleary with you. Time now to turn to arts, culture, spirituality and life. Our guest, Father Richard Leonard. Richard Leonard, a Jesuit. You may remember Richard for his last visit to us and a very powerful, almost autobiographical account of coming to terms with suffering. His sister becoming a quadriplegic in a motor accident in the Northern Territory. A book that's had a wide influence and people. Even last week, Richard, someone commented to me about it. Richard Leonard, welcome to Sunday Night.
Thanks, John. It's great to be back. Thanks for having me.
Richard, we've got you here in your professional capacity this time. Somebody who's taken an interest in art, literature, culture, and particularly in film.
That's right.
Why?
The short answer is my Jesuit provincial told me to go and do it. And when a Jesuit's told what to do, they do what they're told. So I, at the end of my theological studies, I was someone that the Jesuits decided they were going to send to do doctoral studies. And my provincial at the time, Father Bill Uren, who's presently the rector of Newman College at the University of Melbourne, he said, would you think about doing communications and media, and particularly within that, what about cinema studies and television production? So I got sent to the London Film School to do the Master of Fine Arts course there in television production, and then later to do a doctorate with Professor Barbara Creed at the University of Melbourne, writing on Peter Weir, and I wrote on the mystical gaze of the cinema, the films of Peter Weir. And I finished that off at UCLA. And where actually the Peter Weir collection is, but that's for another night and long story.
One shouldn't say that even though that title appears a bit portentous, with the case of Peter Weir, it's not over the top.
Not at all. I know too much about his films, of course. I've seen all of them so many times. But when you think of things like Picnic at Hanging Rock, The Last Wave, Gallipoli, Dead Poets Society, Witness, Master and Commander, The Way Back, the most recent one, The Year of Living Dangerously. Well, these are films that were described as being mystical. So my doctoral studies were looking at what does it mean to describe a film as mystical? Is it just a loose use of language, just a throwaway line, or whether the commentator realises it or not, is he or she making actually something, a much more significant statement than maybe they even realise. And of course, I had a doctorate to write, so I went for the latter option. And Melbourne University Press have published that as a book. And Weir works wonderfully in this most secular of countries, like our own. Our preeminent director, arguably our most successful director, three or maybe even four times now, been nominated for an Oscar, without a win, unfortunately. And he's described as a cinematic mystic time and time and time again.
That resonates, though, with what a number of writers have remarked about Australia. If you go to even to D.H. Lawrence and Kangaroo, he's dealing with a secular culture which he senses has a profound dark mystery somewhere locked in it.
I think the one who probably said it better than anybody was David Tracy and his fantastic commentaries about literature and film and culture, where particularly how our whole narrative of the desert, Voss with Patrick White and Leichhardt and all our explorers and the way that's captured both our painting, our literature and our film, that often it's isolated individuals who go in for this journey into this deserted place only for self-revelation. And indeed, for some of them, it's an explicit pilgrimage, so it has spiritual overtones. They may not be denominational or religious, but they're spiritual.
But with that self-revelation, it's not the American optimism. It's not associated with bleakness and sometimes death and oblivion.
The Go West young man here doesn't work. The Go West young man for America was all about finding the promised land to, have the freedom of the sons and daughters of God. Ours were trying to find, our explorers, of course, were these incredibly brave and no doubt somewhat crazy people who set forth trying to find origins of rivers and other sides of the island and all of those sorts of things, and of course went on these extraordinary journeys.
Yeah, with us it's sort of a crucifixion country rather than a resurrection country, isn't it?
But for the white community it is, yes. Yeah. I think, we can clearly see that we're isolated individuals that are not in the place that we should have been, at least that's not where history had put us originally, and now we had to be tamed by that landscape or we had to tame it. Well, Weir picks up an awful lot of that sort of stuff in his films and puts isolated individuals into somewhat desolate or arid states. Like even if you look at Robin Williams as an isolated creative teacher in a very strict, stern boarding school, trying to inspire boys to discover poetry. And then he gave the Western community whole lines like Carpe Diem and Suck the Marrow Out of Life and all of these lines.
Gave them back to us.
Gave them back to us, that's right. Another generation.
And there's that wonderful moment in Master and Commander, that extraordinary moment where the young man goes overboard and what's the music? It's the Talis Fantasia, the Vaughan Williams.
That's right.
Now, that is an extraordinary sort of piece of insight.
Total sacrificial moment. Like it is almost completely the Christian metaphor of laying down one's lives for one's friends. It's all there on the screen. The other thing about that film is that regular commentators on Master and Commander said there are no women in it, and that's true. Weir, on the whole, likes boys more than he likes women, and so he tends to talk about male communities more than female. And while there were some Polynesian women in boats and other things in that film, the boat was a woman. And, you know, we've seen them caress it and clean it and, you know, and love it as a mother. And to a degree, the sea was too. And the sea was a very tough mother indeed. So there are always feminine figures. He, of course, was heavily influenced by Carl Jung. So
and if you
all
go
of
back
those
to
archetypes
sort of picnic
come
at Hanging
out.
Rock, you get femininity, but it's femininity in a strange, dark way.
It is indeed. Well, the rock itself, of course, is talked about as being in the feminine form. And, you know, these young virgins mount the rock. You know, I don't want to shock our readers at what a priest has thought about when writing a chapter on that. But, you know, it's all there in the commentary. And it's all there actually in the original novella as well. And then we've got Gallipoli, which, you know, gave us David Williamson's screenplay on Bean's mythology, really, of Gallipoli. And, in fact, Peter Weir can take some credit for saving Anzac Day.
And today, Sunday, we're remembering the bombing of Darwin, today,
right,
in 1942. Another mystery which was covered up was buried. The tragedy of it was buried. Now, for good reasons, but it didn't emerge until 25 years after the war.
Yes, that's right. And the other place that, you know, only my mother would love me to say this, because she was in Townsville as a girl, and it was bombed too by the Japanese. I knew only because of our family connection there, but where Australians actually did know the theatre of war in a way that I certainly would have grown up at school never having heard about in a textbook.
We must continue this discussion on Australians and film throughout this series of discussions, which I hope we can continue through the year. But let's focus a minute, because we're coming up to Academy Awards season. So let's have a look at the wider world of film. What have been the big ones for the year? The Australian box office has served up a few interesting things, if that's a measure of our cultural appreciation over the past 12 months.
It certainly has. The big films at Australian box office from anywhere in the world, of course, were the two Harry Potter films and then Transformers. And then we went to Inception and The Hangover, The King's Speech, Pirates of the Caribbean, Bridesmaids, Fast and Furious, Tangled, Red Dog, Twilight, The Smurfs, Cars 2, Kung Fu Panda.
What do we read into that?
Well, a couple of things. There are some fascinating things here. Firstly, there are no R-rated films in the top 25, which goes against what most religious people want to believe about the cinema. And that's not unusual. In fact, the only R-rated film in the top 25 box office films of all time in Australia was Chopper.
Even back to the great age of R-rated films in the 1970s.
Alvin Rides Again and Alvin Purple and, you know, and some of the other pretty nasty ones that were going around at that time.
Or even the arthouse ones like Clockwork Orange. And,
they didn't get into... They wouldn't be... Well, I mean Australian-made, actually. Mm. But Clockwork Orange is not in the top 20 either of all-time box office successes at Australia, which goes against the perception that we will rush off and see very violent and very sexy films and they're the only things that do well at the box office. Well, it's not true, actually. There are two big categories that have done extremely well in the last 25 years. But try telling some church people this. They won't believe you. I'm the director of the Australian Catholic Film Office, and I'm talking to teachers and adults and parents and priests all the time about media and particularly about film. And I'll say this, and they just won't believe you. So you have to actually show it to them. There are two big ones. Apocalyptic fantasy or science fantasy is one category, and animation comedies. They're the two. Now, I think for people with religious and spiritual sensibilities, we should be very, very interested in that first category. What's going on at the cinema? You know, this whole quest for the spiritual Has been going on in the cinema in a very serious way since 1968. Really, 2001, A Space Odyssey kicks it off. And then, of course, Star Wars is when it just explodes. But these narratives are heavily indebted to mythology generally, to religious narrative and to Christian narrative, sometimes to Jewish motifs as well.
They're a way of finding a way back to a story that was getting rusty.
Absolutely. And it's also a curious thing. I can't prove this, but I'd love to be able to do a research project that could. We can show that the rise of attendance at the cinema really takes off for teenagers around 1973 to 1975. And the reason that is that kids have got money. They've got Saturday jobs in, you know, when I was a kid, you know, you had a Saturday job where you worked for McDonald's or whatever you did, and then you had your own money and you went and spent it at the pictures. So that's one of the reasons it takes off. But it's curious then what happens. We can show through a whole lot of surveys of denominational attendance, certainly for Christian denominations, that their attendance at religious collectives goes down from 73 to 75 and then goes from there. We have never recovered in any strong way this age group. But where do they go? They go off to the cinema. And what do they see? Well, it's not as though that they're lacking in metaphysics or metaethics or other worlds, other modes of existence, spirits, souls. Like, think about angels. Angels have never had it as good as they've got it in literature and film right now.
Television.
Every time you turn
around.
Now, I'm a Roman Catholic. We love angels. We're really into them as a sort of an embodiment of God's personal presence, God's personal love, which is what an angel's meant to be, particularly a guardian angel. And so it strikes me as though that's fascinating, that we've walked away from denominational expression or institutional expression of religion, but at the same time, these science and apocalyptic fantasies.
The hunger for some ideal that can be realised, even if it's a long way off.
You know, in the literature, it's the grand title of a meta-narrative, you know, of this great narrative, that we're something bigger than us. And for all of, you know, the serious challenges of atheism and agnosticism now, that hasn't seemed to be waning.
Let's have a look at some of the films for this year. Mm-hmm. I mean, we've talked about Red Dog.
That was a very sweet story.
That was the sort of personal, there is something warm to be found in the heart of things.
Oh, and also community.
Yeah.
That film was all about community and the connection of that whole Northwest Cape. I must admit, in the first few minutes of Red Dog, I thought, oh my God, we have every single Australian stereotype in one bar in Dampier in 1970. And I started to cringe a bit, I've got to say. Once I got over myself, and sort of I then said to myself, this is all the stupid narrative that goes on in a film critic's head. I sat there and I said, well, actually, there probably was every Australian stereotype in a Dampier bar in 1970. And once I got over my own sense of pomposity, actually, I just really enjoyed it. I teared up at least three or four times in Red Dog and loved it to the end. I'm not sure it was the best film we've had in Australia. Last year was a great year for Australian film. There were some fabulous ones, Snowtown being the darkest, and I wouldn't recommend anyone to go and see it. And I wasn't happy with it as a film because, at least from a values or ethical point of view, there was not a voice in that film saying this is wrong. Mm. Now, that wasn't the intention of the writer and director. But, of course, maybe as a clergyman, I need somebody to assert themselves somewhere saying, you know, this is evil.
The question is, what is art for, is raised at that point.
And while I know it was beautifully acted, I know it was wonderfully scripted, I know it was beautifully staged, I had some major ethical concerns of the lack of that voice within it. Because I think you can end up glorifying evil people doing evil things, and it made me exceedingly uncomfortable, that film.
But if I go back to the great Kubrick, Clockwork Orange, there, and it was one of the few films I've ever seen which I thought this actually deserves an R rating. One has to be psychologically equipped, there is a certain level of maturity to understand what Kubrick is getting at, because there is a moral message here.
Yes.
And you're suggesting Snowtown perhaps didn't have that.
They're not dissimilar in one way. They're about torture. Mm. You know, this is actually about torture. Clockwork Orange was a film about torture. And now, it might have been packaged in a certain way and had a certain psychedelic LSD 1972 sort of covering over it. But if you take it away and just look at those scenes and you analyse those scenes, not that I've done this to any great sophistication, but they're scenes of torture and vigilante torture too. So I think that's always to be decried. And Snowtown, well, we've got evil characters trying to manipulate more vulnerable people to be part of just absolutely evil crimes. And the worst thing for me was that I just sit at those films wondering whether, in fact, they're made too quickly. There could be people listening to us right now whose relatives were the victims of Snowtown. And there are clearly people who are listening to us in Snowtown right now in South Australia who lived through that horrific chapter. I sometimes think you've got to get a bit of distance to tell that story. So I was profoundly uncomfortable. As much as I could admire it as a film, ethically and personally, it made me exceptionally uncomfortable. And maybe that was exactly what it was meant to do.
Let's turn to the Academy Awards list for this year. And looking through it briefly, what interested me, and particularly over this Australian summer, the films that are showing seem in every category, whether it's the political movie, the family entertainment movie, or the child's adventure movie, there is a sense of idealism and aspiration. Idealism lost in the Ides of March, for example, or the heroism of War Horse. In all of them, there seems to be some of this aspirational hunger or idealism that you're talking about. Is that a return from what was the standard operating manual of the 1970s to 1990s film? Is there something new emerging in film culture?
Well, if we look at the list this year, and we'll just go through it really quickly, what's nominated is The Artist, The Descendants, Extremely Loud and Incredibly Close, Hugo, Midnight in Paris, The Help, Moneyball, War Horse and The Tree of Life. Okay. The one thing that strikes me about that list wouldn't be aspirational. I'd probably couch it in terms of nostalgia. The word nostalgia is a wonderful word. It comes from the Greek word nostalgia, of course, meaning a yearning to be at home. Yes. So a looking back. Yes. If you look at those films...
But it's looking back towards something good or something better.
Yes, but not always with golden eyes. Like War Horse was clearly 1912 and, looking back to this glory where, one horse survives. I wasn't mad keen on War Horse,
The critical reception of the movie was nowhere near as favourable as the critical reception of the play. Yeah.
I just found the film too saccharine for me, and you could almost predict it. And I just said, One Horse Survives. If some of our listeners haven't seen that film, I've just wrecked it for you. I'm sorry. But I'm sure before you got there, you could probably work out that was going to happen. But if you look at Midnight in Paris, we're back into the 20s. In Hugo, in the 30s, with The Artist, which is a very demanding film and will probably take our best picture.
Well, both Hugo and The Artist are a nostalgia for an earlier film culture too.
Very much so.
In Hugo, you go back to the beginnings of film and film fantasy with Georges Méliès, and with The Artist, it's the transition from silent to sound, which has been done many times, but this time...
Well, that was the thing that struck me about them. I wondered whether, in fact, there's a fair bit of socio-political comment about the cinema that goes, that when we look backwards, we're often wanting to go back to a more secure time, a safer time. So we're in a very unstable period now. So our cinema, our literature, our television tends to go back. Like, it's not by mistake that Downton Abbey is doing well on television here in the UK and in the USA, because, this is a time when everyone had a role and everybody knew their role and the world was a terribly predictable place. As beautiful as it's made, simply as a television program, there's inches of commentary from a psychological and sociological point of view of the significance of that. One thing that is a bit different about these films that are nominated this year, particularly, I think, The Artist and Hugo, is the world is changing. Like, the period they're talking about and looking to is, in fact, a changing world. So it's like they're trying to navigate the change now, which is fundamentally happening in Western society, particularly economically, but looking through another period which went through an enormous upheaval or change, and how did they do it? And on the whole, it's human relationships which end up being the story of finding your voice, like in The Artist. For those of our listeners may not go and see The Artist, it is almost totally silent. There's obviously a very big soundtrack or music track that goes with it,
a
very
glorious
lush one.
Black and white.
Glorious black and white, beautifully shot. The production values are incredibly high, and it does remind you that you can tell a story without saying pretty well a word, although there are the black and white cards. So it picks up all of that wonderful late 1920s, the best values of those wonderful black and white films. But it's pretty demanding. It wouldn't be everybody's cup of tea, but it's going to win the Oscar. It's won the BAFTA, it's won the the Golden Globe. It's going to be walked out with the Directors Guild of America. These are big forerunners to being in a prime location to win the Oscar.
And you had two George Clooney films this year, quite different. The Ides of March, much in the tone of his political interests, and The Descendants, quite a surprise.
Yes, he co-wrote The Ides of March, which a lot of people have forgotten. He's been nominated for an Oscar, and I don't think they're going to win it, but they could. The interesting thing about The Ides of March, for those of us who have seen it, is by the end of the film, there's not a nice character in it. Like, everybody is a morally complex, morally compromised person. That's a brave film these days, because normally, while the Ryan Gosling character is somebody we like initially, we find he's a bit flawed too by the end. The other one, for my money, was a wonderful film. I love The Descendants. That's, by the way, the only film that's nominated right now which is set in contemporary Hawaii, because The Ides of March is not in that Best Picture category, but The Descendants is. And I think it was a terrific film, because just when you think you know where that film's going, with the wife having had the accident and being on life support, and the two children, the bulgy 17-year-old and the gorgeous 11-year-old daughters of George Clooney's character, then all of a sudden it takes a turn, and I won't say any more than that, takes a turn and it goes into another realm altogether. So it's a small picture from the point of view of the narrative, the story, but emotionally packs a wonderful punch, because every single character goes on a fantastic journey. They go somewhere which is life-giving, painful, but life-giving, and I loved it.
I can't live without two other movies, both political, The Iron Lady and Tinker Tailor. The Iron Lady, a biopic of Margaret Thatcher. Tinker Tailor, a very brave remake of the classic Le Carré novel, which everyone thought Alec Guinness has done it and there's nothing more to be said.
Yes, and in fact in the blogosphere, in cinema websites, there's a lot of anger that Tinker Tailor isn't doing better in awards season. Even at the BAFTAs, there were people who thought it would knock off The Artist. In fact, it won Best British Film. And it is a classic British remake because it's so cool. I think, to a degree, it's a bit too cold for me. It's many years since I've read the Le Carré novel, but I remember it being a little more colourful and a little bit more dynamic. This, even the tone of the clothing, the tone of the cinematography, everything's grey and dark. And, of course, they want to get us back into the Cold War. But I do think it lacked something there. I needed something a little bit more lively. The other one, The Iron Lady, Meryl Streep's going to win the Oscar for Best Actress, and she probably deserves it, although I've got to say I didn't walk away from that film loving it. I got a little bit sick of watching an old lady talking to her dead husband, and I assume that's there to humanise Margaret Thatcher, to make her more accessible to a modern audience. But I think we got that fairly early on. And then I think the most interesting chapters of her life, of which, the audience is going to be polarised of whether she was a gift to Britain or not, and indeed to the world, we were just given sort of like headlines. And I thought that did a bit of a disservice to whether one loved or hated Margaret Thatcher. Well, she was one of the great forces, she and Ronald Reagan in the 80s.
Perhaps the best thing that can be said of the film is the essays that it's provoked.
Well, that's certainly true. But there's one film that I think we got it last year. Of Gods and Men, for me, last year was one of the great films. Now, it came out in 2010, and we got it in 2011, and I'm not sure where else it went around the world. It did very well at the Cannes Film Festival, but I'm really sorry to see it. Maybe its time has passed, but it's for my money, it was one of the best films that came out at the Australian box office last year. The French film about the Trappist monks in Algeria. And it wasn't just because it's about Catholic priests that I like it. It's just a beautiful story about commitment, about fidelity, and about discernment of how do we make choices. And it's the anatomy of making a choice, just as an individual and also as a group.
And film at its best does that. One can go back, if you're taking the Catholic priest analogy, and think of something like Diary of a Country Priest, which has to be one of the great films, independent of whether you're talking about spirituality.
Or on the waterfront.
Indeed.
Another superb one.
Much more to talk about. Richard Leonard, thanks so much for joining us.
John,
on Sunday
great
night.
Pleasure. Thanks for having me back.
This has been a podcast of Sunday Nights on ABC Local Radio. You can download your favourite Sunday night interviews from our website at abc.net.au/Sunday Nights with an S. Thank you for listening.